Where do we go from here? To the land of fish frying podcasts. That's where. Hey, everybody, welcome to episode number 461 of this here electronic engineering podcast called Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by eejournal.com and written, produced, and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. Longtime friend of the show, Bob Smith from the ESD Alliance, is joining us today. Bob and I are chatting about a new anti-piracy server certification protocol for software license management and why this new kind of server certification protocol is needed now more than ever before. But before we bring in Bob, it's time for a little news you may have missed. Did you know that a simplified quantum computer can now be made with off-the-shelf components? It's true. We all know that current quantum computers aren't exactly easy to build. They are also quite difficult to scale and need extremely cold temperatures to operate. Well, it was because of these reasons that a team of researchers from Stanford University sought out a different way to create a quantum computer, with the help from photons. So, why photons? Well, not only can they carry information easily, but they can also operate at room temperature. Until now, researchers have created individual quantum logic gates using this method, but they have not connected them to perform complex calculations. Yep, you heard me right. Until now. So, in a research paper published late last month, a team of researchers from Stanford University are proposing a whole new design for a quantum computer. And their design actually uses a laser to manipulate a single atom. That atom then can modify the state of the photons through a process called quantum teleportation. The atom can also be reset and reused for many quantum gates. This is important because it eliminates the need to build multiple distinct physical gates and vastly reduces the complexity of building a quantum computer. Ben Bartlett, a PhD candidate in applied physics and lead author of the paper, explains this aspect of their research like this. Normally, if you wanted to build this type of quantum computer, you'd have to take potentially thousands of quantum emitters, make them all perfectly indistinguishable, and then integrate them into a giant photonic circuit. Whereas with this design, we only need a handful of relatively simple components, and the size of the machine doesn't increase with the size of the quantum program you want to run. So what all are we talking about when it comes to these simplified quantum computers? This setup, created by this team from Stanford, only requires a couple pieces of equipment: a pair of optical switches, an optical cavity, a beam splitter, and a fiber optic cable. And yes, if you were reviewing this bomb in your head, they are all fully available off-the-shelf components. The actual design of these new simplified quantum computers is really cool. They only contain two main sections, a scattering unit and a storage ring. So first, the storage ring. It is actually a fiber optic loop that can hold multiple photons that travel around the ring. And each photon represents a quantum bit, or qubit. And the direction of travel around the storage ring by this qubit determines its value. Also, because these photons can simultaneously exist in two states at once, an individual photon can also flow in both directions at once, which can represent a value that is a combination of 1 and 0 at the same time. Next, that scattering unit. So this team of researchers found that they could manipulate the photons by directing it from the storage unit into the scattering unit, and from there, it travels to a cavity that contains one single atom. When it reaches that atom, they interact, causing the atom and photon to become entangled, which is a quantum phenomenon where two particles can influence each other even across great distances. From there, the photon actually returns to the storage ring, and the laser alters the state of the atom. And since they have become entangled, a manipulation of the atom also changes the state of the paired photon as well. So in principle, you can run any quantum program using just one controllable atomic qubit, because quantum logic gates can be compiled into a series of operations performed on the atom. In order to run a program, the code is actually translated into a sequence of operations that direct the photons into the scattering unit and manipulate the atomic qubit. The key here is because you can control the way the photons and atom interact, the same device can run many different quantum programs. Stanford researcher Ben Bartlett explains it like this. For many photonic quantum computers, the gates are physical structures that photons pass through. So if you want to change the program it's running, it involves physically reconfiguring the hardware. Whereas in this case, you don't need to change the hardware. You just need to give the machine a different set of instructions. Wow. Simplified quantum computers, here we come. So if you want even more information about this super cool study, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page on eejournal.com, including a link to the associated research paper called Deterministic Photonic Quantum Computation in a Synthetic Time Dimension. Cool. All right, let's switch things up and bring in Bob Smith from the ESD Alliance.
Hi, Bob. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Amelia. It's been a long time. Good to hear from you.
It has been a long time. All right. So, Bob, let's talk about the ESD Alliance. Now, you guys have led a years-long joint development effort to complete an anti-piracy server certification protocol for software license management. Now, tell me more about this.
Sure. It's kind of a long name, isn't it?
It is.
So this is actually, I think, a great example of why an organization like the ESD Alliance actually exists. And one of the primary purposes is to enable companies in an industry, even though they're competing with each other, to get together to solve problems that affect the whole industry. And this is a poster child, if you will, for the kind of collaborative work that can go on even between competitors. So in this case, the issue was software piracy. Imagine someone buying a few expensive licenses of EDA software, and then all of a sudden you discover that, well, they paid for two licenses. We see they're using 75 licenses. How did that happen? This is not a problem with big companies, really, and honest customers. But it is a problem just with some people that just basically are gaming the system. And what they've been able to do, because of the way that this expensive software is licensed, there's a server, a host machine that basically authorizes licenses for use. Well, it turns out there are ways to, for lack of a better word, spoof that server, or to make it appear that there are multiple servers that have the right to give out these licenses. So this effort is essentially going to mitigate that.
For sure. Now, Bob, why is server certification protocol needed now? What exactly is the problem you're trying to solve?
The problem we are trying to solve is the cloning of server host IDs. So in essence, write some code that makes it appear to the license manager that, oh, there's all these host server ID, and oh, it could give me, a few licenses, and here's another one that's really just a clone that can give me a few licenses. So the problem is, it's unfair to both the customers and the vendors that develop this software. If I'm a customer, imagine I've just invested several million dollars to buy new EDA software for a hot new product I'm trying to get out, and I have some shadowy competitor who is trying to copy me, and they're not paying at all, or they're paying almost nothing for the software, yet they're getting much wider access to the software. And of course, it hurts the vendors too, because I think a little known fact about EDA vendors is how much money companies spend of R&D dollars to develop and stay up with the market and the new processes. The big EDA companies spend anywhere from 35 to a little over 40% of every revenue dollar that comes in gets plowed back into R&D. It kind of blows your mind. It's even more than the pharmaceutical industries and so forth. So they spend, EDA guys have to spend a lot of money to keep their products. And if all of a sudden, you know, a bunch of your market is stealing the products, well, how are you going to keep up? The only thing you can do is either raise the prices, increase the subscription rates, and that's not good for anybody. So it's literally a billion-dollar problem. And this protocol is able to uniquely identify machines. So you have a fingerprint, I have a fingerprint. You can uniquely identify a human through their fingerprint or an iris scan. Well, it turns out that hardware machines all have their own little subtle differences. And this protocol is meant to be essentially a tool in the license management scheme that allows vendors to very uniquely identify which servers are actually licensed to give out the software and to make sure it's really them and not an imposter.
That makes sense. Now, which companies were involved in this joint development effort?
So there was a lot of interest in this. When we kicked off the project, we went out to all of our membership and asked for expressions of interest to actually participate in the development. And I guess no surprise, but the three that came back were Cadence, Mentor, which is of course now Siemens EDA, and Synopsys. And they all basically put folks on their staffs into this development team to come up with first kind of to spec out what would the protocol look like, and then to actually come up with the protocol itself that they could then all use in their own license management schemes. The one clear thing that came out of this was, even though all of these companies have a slightly different license management software that they give their customers, they all agreed that for this protocol to be accepted and to be really effective, they all needed to employ it in their own embodiment. So that doesn't mean all of their license management software is identical. It's not, but it means this piece of it will be based on this protocol, which actually we've already started moving towards a standard.
Excellent. Now, what's the status? I know you're moving toward the standard, but is it finished?
So what's happening? Two things. One is we have started it into the standardization process flow at SEMI. The second thing that they're doing, and another really cool thing about this project, in my opinion, was that when they first came up with the idea, they brought in some big customers. So the people that would actually buy their licenses, and they said, hey, we're thinking of doing this. Here's why we're doing it. And we want to make sure you're okay with this. Because the last thing you'd want to do is have one of your biggest customers say, wait a minute, why are you changing all this stuff? This is hurting my business. And it might have me lose access to the software in some situation. So they were very transparent. They brought these folks in and they got a ringing endorsement really for developing this. Okay, so then a year went by and now they've actually fleshed out what the actual protocol looks like. So what they did is they're now back with these same large companies, having them, you know, under non-disclosure, review the protocol to get their blessing. So far, it's going very well. None of us anticipate any issues with it, but I think it's also great that we're doing that as a separate step. It's like the old thing about developing new dog food. You want to make sure that it doesn't upset the dogs and that they're going to like it. So these big companies are extremely supportive for the reason I explained earlier, and that is, hey, I'm investing millions of dollars in this software to have a competitive edge. And if there's some guy around the street that's basically stealing it, that's not fair to me either. That almost puts them on an even footing with me. So like I said, it's not just about dollars to the EDA vendors. It's also protecting the competitive rights of the large customers.
That makes sense. Now, I understand that the ESD Alliance is proposing this become a semi-standard. So how long will that process take?
Our best guess is it will probably take 6 months to a year. And I'm going to lean towards, I think it could take up to a year. One of the reasons for that is this will be the first standard that SEMI has many standards. I forget. They have, well, I think over 1,500 standards in use in the semiconductor industry. But this is the first standard that will actually fall under the banner of being a standard for semiconductor design. So the way the process works is there's usually a technical group that it falls under, and then there's a committee assigned to essentially vet the standard and really research it. And since there hasn't been any design standards at SEMI, we're working with SEMI to figure out, okay, who are the right people to pull into this committee to work on this? Now, having said that, I also should say that having it standardized is a really good thing. It's good for the industry, but in no way will it prevent certainly the development partners from starting to use it, you know, for their own purposes, nor will it prevent SEMI and by abstraction, the ESD Alliance from actually licensing it to other vendors out there that, you know, we feel are legitimate. This is kind of like, imagine you developed a new lock and now you have people that want to license your patent to this lock and the way it works. Well, you kind of need to be careful who you license it to for obvious reasons, I think. So, but standard is important, but it won't stop us. It won't stop SEMI from entering into licensing agreements with people that can actually use it to help further the business for all of us.
That makes sense. Now, the ESD Alliance made news recently with the announcement that the industry revenue increased 14.6% year over year, the highest annual growth since 2011. So, Bob, what do you think accounts for that growth?
I kind of tend to subscribe to the idea that we're actually at the beginning of this big revolution in microelectronics, if you will. And that may sound kind of crazy because we've been doing this for a long time, but think about just all the things we've witnessed, frankly, since the pandemic, which we'd love to have in the rearview mirror. But just one I'll pick on is telehealth, what we call med tech. It's an exploding field. And the pandemic, in a sense, forced part of that because all of a sudden, you know, you couldn't just drop in at your doctor's office. You could get an in-person visit after a COVID test, or you could get on a Zoom call to meet with a doctor if it wasn't a life-threatening situation. So I think in the automotive space, that's accelerating faster than anybody thought, especially the switch to electric vehicles. And of course, there's autonomous driving, the rollout of 5G. And so it's interesting, but I think we're at the beginning of, you know, we're not at a curve that's starting to slope off. I think it's accelerating for more electronics. And I think that's what's going on. In fact, just all the investment dollars that have gone into AI and machine learning semiconductor companies is kind of, you know, mind-boggling. There's, you know, hundreds of companies that have started and have got funded. So I think there's all this pent-up demand and this kind of new revolution that's going on. Just one kind of example of an article I just read this morning about the new Google Pixel phone. They're using their Tensor chip in that phone. And for a lot of things like converting voice to type and other functions, it won't go to the cloud. All the AI is actually built into the phone. It's kind of hard to believe, but that's what they're saying.
That's fantastic. All right. And that absolutely makes sense, Bob. So let's move on to the bonus question. You're off the cuff for today. Now, we have talked a lot in the past about jazz cellars. So what's the latest with your vineyard? And you guys are in harvest season right now, are you?
Well, let me clarify. We have a winery. We actually don't have a vineyard. We decided when we started 16 years ago that rather than be farmers, I have nothing against farmers. I have the utmost respect for the people that grow grapes, but it's a tough business. And then as my partner and I like to say, it's also tough to make the wine and then, you know, market it and sell it. But to answer your question, harvest was actually early this year. We're done. I mean, we were surprised that our first fruit, Viognier in particular, came in before the end of August, which is a little bit unusual, but most of our fruit is coming from up in the foothills here in California. The growing season, it got quite warm during the latter summer months, and boom, everything was ready to go. So we're done with harvest, and now we're sitting with a lot of wine and barrels waiting for it to mature so we can bottle it early next year.
Fantastic. Well, Bob, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
And before we go, don't forget to check out my new maker-themed monthly fish fry podcast series called Makers Today. In our sixth episode of this series, I chat with Richard Curtin and Katie Chubb from OKDo. We chat all about OKDo's mission to encourage inspiration with the OKDo Projects Hub, how you can recycle your pre-loved raspberry pies with their new OKDo Renew program, and how they are encouraging STEM education throughout the world. And you can check out this episode of Makers Today by clicking the link below the player on this week's fish frying page on eejournal.com. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, sure, you can follow us or me on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series, hosted by, who is that? Me. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can subscribe to this here podcast through Spotify, Podbean, or Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you'd like to further support this podcast, please leave me a review on that podcasting platform of your choice. It really does help. Also, if you'd like any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology or, heck, you just want to chat, shoot me a line at Amelia, that's A-M-E-L-I-A, at eejournal.com, or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of December 10th, 2021, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.